You've done scholarly research service by presenting podcasts with lots of other researchers, so I think it's only fair that you too get the opportunity to be the bird on the bird table and the ornithologist looking on, for which I'm very happy to play that role. So, a key focus of interest in this particular podcast is the relation between text and mental health. And your work has clearly taken up that emphasis with respect to eating disorders in particular. Could you perhaps describe some of the discoveries that you've made in the course of that research?
I suppose the main discovery is this stuff does actually matter. I mean, it's easy to sit in a place like this, you know, centre of the University of Oxford, surrounded by all these other people who think things like literature are important, and to come to believe that too, and to kind of think that it might be a good idea to find some evidence of exactly how, but actually never to really ask the question, like, does it matter? And if so, in what ways?
And with respect to the specific ways in which it matters, I mean, that it matters, yes, is obviously a crucial discovery, because that energizes lots of subsequent research, your own and anyone else who wants to take up that emphasis. What's the kind of the specific kind of hypothesis that you validated or disconfirmed?
Yeah, I suppose when it comes to the fact that it matters, the way that seemed to play out in the only admittedly self-report data that we've gathered so far is that it matters both positively and negatively. That is, reading stuff can be bad for you and also good for you. That's the crux of the main surprise that there was for me in the whole thing. But again, it's just so easy to generalise about, you know, advertising is always going to be bad for us, and reading books that come bound in nice covers is always going to be good for us. And I suppose one thing that conducting the survey with Beat really showed for me is just how dangerous those kind of generalizations are. So more specifically, the essence of the findings was, if you suffer from or are in recovery from an eating disorder, then it's quite a risky thing to read anything that is thematically focused on eating disorders. Like, you might think, and a lot of the prevailing wisdom about things like bibliotherapy would lead you to expect that reading stuff about people in your situation, reading about how they managed to get through it, how they recognise what was wrong, would be helpful, and indeed I'm sure it's in cases it is. But that comes with a lot of risks which are perhaps somewhat particular to the eating disorder context of finding yourself wanting to become competitive with the protagonist who has the eating disorder, finding yourself just caught up even more obsessively than you already were in that mindset. So there's those kind of risks and benefits on the side of stuff that you might read that would be thematically linked to disordered eating. And then on the other hand, there's all the other things that you might read just for any of the number of other reasons that you read anything. And the picture there, as you might expect, seems much more mixed, because that's like all the other books in the world, so how are you meant to really generalise at all? But one of the things that did come out strongly in the survey data was the potential of those other kinds of reading preferences to improve mood, to make you feel better about stuff. And it's easy to look down on that kind of effect as not very sophisticated or interesting somehow, but I think just feeling more cheerful for a few hours is probably quite an important thing.
There are large classes of people who take drugs for that very purpose, you know, being cheerful for a few hours. No, I think it's very fascinating what you've hit upon there, both in terms of the exact results that you have and the bigger kind of intellectual picture that you insert them into. And it's kind of ironic, I think, even a little bit, that there's this big, or at least it used to be, an emphasis on the possibly corrupting effects of literature from certain religious perspectives, for instance, and you banned books and, you know, books that ran, they were seen as being, you know, subversive of public morals and so on. And one of the great critical and liberatory movements of the 60s was to say, okay, we don't buy that story anymore. But this is kind of doubling back with a bit more nuance, admittedly, as you say, with respect to a very specific community of readers. But nevertheless, this idea of the effect of the text upon the reader as being something measurable and quantifiable and something that we can say something about, I think, is an important move, not just in terms of the specific area of research that you do, although it's important there, but it does add to a certain sense that, you know, this idea of looking at the text and nothing but the text isn't really going to give us the full picture. What I quite like about your discoveries is that it makes that very, very solid, very hard to disagree with. And I think that kind of leads into my next question, which is that over the course of your junior research fellowship, you basically wrote a monograph on Franz Kafka, Kafka's Cognitive Realism, available in all bookshops. I recommend it for you. And in that, you advance a very provocative hypothesis, which is that Kafka's, the seemingly strange world of his fiction is actually strange because it is in fact so intimately familiar, because it is an actual description of cognitive processes, as opposed to what we think cognitive processes are, which is a subtle distinction, but an important one. But I think in respect of what you do with respect to eating disorders, there's again this link on cognition and on text and on writing. Do you see those two aspects of your research as being continuous with each other, or is it just a happy coincidence?
Well, they very much arose one out of the other. This project started as everything in my intellectual life seems to, with Kafka and with his story, A Hunger Artist, which also, of course, happens to be the name of my blog. Hunger Artist seemed to have been following me around for a while. So the link was an article that I wrote on The Hunger Artist, which is a story about a man who fasts for other people's entertainment, and he's awfully popular to begin with, and people rush to see him, and then gradually his popularity starts to wane and they rush past him to see the much more interesting circus animals. And in the end it becomes clear that he wasn't really fasting to entertain other people, he was fasting because he didn't know what else to do. And anyway, I'd read this story millions of times, and then at some point suddenly realised that although Kafka describes him as the Hungerkünstler, the hunger artist or the fasting artist, he's never once described as feeling any hunger, which I thought, well, that's interesting. And it's also really interesting that I didn't notice it, because I would have thought, given my own history of anorexia, I should be very acutely aware of things like whether people are or aren't hungry when they're not eating anything. And so I started to ask a question about what difference it might make that I was coming at this story with a particular history, and also how cognitively realistic that description of this man's hunger and his fasting, or his absence of hunger and his fasting, are, and you know, whether he's actually basically got anorexia or something else, or some weird combination of not quite realistic things. And so exploring that story from the perspective of those questions then opened out into a wider empirical project that was not just like me and my responses, but trying to get at some of these questions a bit more broadly. I haven't yet begun really to put the theoretical framework that structured the monograph, so the idea of cognitive realism, together with the questions that I've been asking empirically in this new eating disorder project. I definitely think the links are there to be made. I don't necessarily want to shoehorn everything into cognitive realism, because other stuff is important too, but I mean, something that I've given a little bit of thought to is what always fascinated me with Kafka was the imaginative, the prompts to imagine in the visual mode the places and the actions that he describes. And one of my conclusions was he gives us just bizarrely little detail about anything, but that doesn't matter because we actually make do with bizarrely little detail in our visual lives anyway. So one of the assumptions that suggestion goes against is that in order to make us have meaningful and powerful imaginative experiences, a writer needs to describe everything in lots and lots of detail in order to give you like a really detailed picture of what's going on.
The Dickens effect, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that way of writing can be very powerful too, but there are other ways of being powerful. And I wonder whether in the eating disorder context, where so much becomes focused on bodies and on shapes and sizes of bodies and the impressions that also fragmented parts of bodies make, like they're sort of looking in the mirror and probably not seeing, you know, an obese person even though you're emaciated in that kind of cliched way, but zooming in on a particular part of your body and just seeing, okay, tummy isn't concave enough, therefore must be fat. You know, doing all that kind of stuff is a weird amalgam of sort of vision and imagination and inference and all that stuff. And it strikes me that if you have a textual prompt to imagine in a quite underdetermined way, then there's a lot more scope for all that kind of messed up stuff to start happening. So if you, I don't know, you just had a description in passing of a woman who was, I don't know, delightfully slender, then, you know, it's up to you to sort of build in all that stuff and start comparing with yourself. And whereas if you, I don't know, you have a breakdown of like all the sort of statistics of the body's size and shape and features and stuff, that would have a different effect, and also it might be damaging or opposite. But, you know, I don't think more is always more potent in either the positive or the negative direction. Uh-huh. And uh-huh. and so to start exploring, you know, the details of how these cognitive perceptual processes play out
mm-hmm.
in response to mm-hmm. different textual mm-hmm. prompts would be really fun.
Yeah, I think certainly it would. I mean, as you're kind of speaking there, kind of, you know, it strikes me that we're perpetually surprised by our own bodies. In the sense, if you catch your reflection in the mirror when you don't think there's a mirror there, or you hear your own voice, you know, as you will soon, you know, it's always slightly startling, slightly jarring. And it kind of, you know, that is certainly kind of almost like that cognitive Kafkaesque effect of seeing yourself alienated to yourself. And you look at the sufferer from an eating disorder, and of course, what he or she doesn't see is their body as seen by others. And, you know, that whole interplay of, like, the narrative construction of the body and the body as it's perceived by others and, you know, the self-perception. I think you're standing on the threshold of a magnificently rich and detailed research project there alone that brings in so many of those things. It would be certainly interesting to see, I think, how that kind of works out going forward.
Yeah, I think there's some kind of investigation of, I don't know, the interplay of maybe alienation and recognition, self-recognition be very interesting in this context, because often that feeling of seeing someone who reflects, reading about someone who reflects important aspects of who you are at the moment
mm-hmm.
can be, I mean, it's often deeply disturbing because often what you see reflected is not particularly flattering.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, so then you get this sort of push away effect, but then also with being pulled in by the fact that mm-hmm. okay, I can learn something from this and I can do something with it. Yeah. And
there can be compassion in there too. You know, you see yourself from the perspective of somebody more forgiving than yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a useful exercise as well.
Or seeing who you could be as well. I mean, I think that was one of the powerful things that came through in the qualitative responses that survey respondents gave, is just remembering that it doesn't have to be like this.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be the person that it feels like you are right now.
Mm-hmm. 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 In that, and I think you're methodologically kind of gesturing towards this already when you were talking about the undetermination of the Kafkaesque scene, is an emphasis which is decidedly unusual for a humanities-trained scholar, which is an emphasis on the experimental. And that, for the last good few years, I would think, has been a fairly constant theme in the work that you're doing. And if I say that's unusual, that's probably not giving it a full kind of proper representation of what it can represent in the context of humanities scholarship, which tends to be very, very inimical to experimental approaches, which tends to see them as being positivistic and reductive. And in fact, what you must very much avoid doing because of the space of the humanities is interpretive and evaluative. So you've done something, I think, quite difficult there. Would you like to say why you chose to make that kind of bold move in your research?
Well, it started again with Kafka and my doctorate and having a big crisis of faith before I even started doctorate, because I'd submitted this...
Best time for it.
I'd submitted this awful proposal to the AHRC for doctoral funding, which they accepted, and it was just... There was nothing in it that I was really interested in, and it was, you know, it was a lot more my supervisor... I mean, thanks to her for getting me the money, but I didn't want to do the thing about representation of space and modernism and how it was... poised between rhetorical and representationalist traditions or whatever. Like, so then I had to work out, well, what do I care about? And my parents, being scientists, said, well, is there a question that you really want to answer? And if not, well, maybe don't do a doctorate. And if so, what is it?
Mm-hmm.
And I realised that my question was, well, what makes Kafka's writing so wonderful? And then I had to work out how to start answering that question, but it rapidly became clear that it was a cognitive question, in the sense that something seeming wonderful to us is about that interaction between the text and the mind. And the thing that I'd always been hung up about with space, like, because it's just one of those sort of humanities monoliths, was actually more about vision, about perception, about imagination. And so, and you can't really meaningfully, well, I mean, people do, but you shouldn't do research on those things without understanding some of the contemporary side of how these things really work in actual minds. So that led me into lots of vision science in particular, which I found, there was one paper in particular on a sensory motor account of vision and visual consciousness, which just seemed like the answer to everything that I'd ever asked about Casper. And of course, all those things are absolutely empirically grounded, although that was a collaboration between a psychologist and a philosopher. And so I suppose, you know, through parental influences also, but through really delving quite deeply into all that kind of psychology and philosophy of mind, I was being gradually won over to the idea that, you know, it's very nice to come up with hypotheses based on your own experience, but then you need to do something to test them beyond that experience. And so the first experiment that I did was quite a disaster. My supervisor was skeptical and kindly arranged a meeting with an experimental psychologist colleague of hers, who told me to do all the sensible things which I should definitely in retrospect have done, like using rating scales and working out how you're going to do the statistical analysis in advance and things like that. And I was determined not to do the boring old thing that psychologists do, because I didn't want to just predetermine everything with Likert scales and, you know. Ended up with a massive sort of completely unwieldy qualitative data which I had no idea what to do with. And in any way, the findings were pretty, in some respects, pretty unusable, although they did form part of the doctoral thesis. And I guess since then, my experimental work has been, again, that sort of balancing act between trying to answer the questions I really want to answer and trying to get any kind of answer which is usable. But, you know, that despite all the problems with doing these experiments, I've done a few others in the meantime on less health-related questions. They remain just so exciting, because you find yourself on that precipice of actually being about to, when you click go on the MATLAB software, you know, whatever, to start the analysis, you know you might be on the verge of finding something out, actually, for real.
Or not.
Or not. Yeah. And usually it's muddy and not easy to incorporate into any of the hypotheses you had or whatever. But, you know, it's at least you've not just been wandering.
No, I think you're probably being a little hard on yourself there, in that the methodologies are typically kind of straightforward. It's coming up with good hypotheses is the hard thing. And the results you got from the BEAT survey, which, you know, have subsequently been published in a pretty good journal, to actually take something from that point to come up with a pretty diffuse data set in the form of the questions that you're asking with respect to text and with respect to a big constituency of people, and to bring that down, to funnel it down to a set of concrete discoveries. Most psychology experiments don't work out that well. So, you know, you're doing a lot of things right, you're doing everything right, to be fair, because if everybody could produce that kind of outcome, well then, you know, I'm pretty sure that most experimental psychologists would be very happy to do so.
Well, thank you. I'm very aware that this, you know, a survey must always be only a first step, and, you know, it's just getting at what people can report on, often years or potentially even decades after the fact of the experiences they're talking about. You know, there's all kinds of limitations, but as you say, it does. There are some real findings in there. It'll be important to build on them.
Well, I mean, I tried a similar methodology not too long ago with respect to a non-illness population, and I got nothing back. So I mean, you picked out your right questions and your right people, and I think that's important. In the discussion we've been having so far, there's a clear sense of your personal experiences and your academic interests kind of coinciding with each other and aligning with each other and kind of, you know, knotting up with each other in all sorts of interesting ways. I think most people can see that that could be very enabling, because it gives you an automatic kind of interest in certain topics that you wish to pursue, such as eating disorder research and so on. But at the same time, you could also see it as something that kind of constrains what you'd like to do. And do you have any thoughts on that kind of oscillation between the constraints and the opportunities that your personal and professional kind of experiences impose on each other?
Yeah, the possibilities, I suppose, come primarily down to the possibility of doing some good and also drawing some good out of a lot of bad, which just, you know, is bound to feel lovely. And I don't have any illusions about altruism as any more than another form of selfishness, but it feels nice to be doing some stuff that's useful and also making good on a decade of being fairly miserable. I suppose in that sense it feels like a benefit to have had life experiences that have given me a particular perspective that, you know, every perspective is by definition also a limitation, but this one gives me a particular take on what it means to read literature. It gives me a particular take on what treatment protocols in inpatient wards look like. It, you know, it does all that, and it gives me a spin and a way of getting my teeth into stuff. In that sense, maybe it's just as simple as sort of having your choices narrowed down for you, because a lot of the overwhelmingness of being alive is just having too many choices all the time.
And
it's actually rather nice to accept sometimes that because of the history that you've had, it makes sense to do a particular set of things, at least for a while. But I suppose that leads on to the constraints, which I guess at the moment maybe could be summarized as everything I'm doing is about eating disorders, and I really don't like eating disorders, like, they're shit. It would be nice if no one ever had one again. And I'm very aware that I don't want my whole life to be about them. And at the moment it's quite fun, and I'm doing enough varied things to do with disordered eating that I don't feel like I'm in a rut or just making myself mentally stale. I'm doing this literary research, I'm doing recovery coaching, and I'm writing a book, I'm creating an app, and all these things are very different sort of takes on the same general area. But I try to keep my mind open to the question of what comes after this phase of my life, and to other questions that aren't just about, you know, anorexia and control and eating and not eating and all that stuff. I'm not sure whether that's exactly what you meant by your question. But
no, it is. It is very much. If you allow me an observation, though, I think another kind of interesting interstitial space that you're kind of in, but a lot of researchers aren't, is that you're taking up stuff which is obviously intrinsic to your identity and your past identity, certainly, and obviously in how you define yourself now. And, you know, lots of people in the humanities and social sciences in particular do that vis-a-vis their research areas. They take up that identity issue and they pursue it. And often that's allied with a certain kind of progressive politics, which introduces another set of issues and agendas that they interact with. But there's a sense in which you don't have that political opportunity, because there is no constituency of people who suffer from eating disorders who want political power or change or any of those bigger things. Now, obviously, it does feed into the issue of, you know, equitable outcomes for mental health versus, let's say, physical health. And, you know, I'm not saying the issue doesn't have a political dimension. It clearly does. But you get the rare opportunity to take something that's intrinsic to your identity and not politicize it. And that's odd. When we do identity politics, the first thing on the table is politics. And you get away from that. And I think it gives your research a certain very interesting kind of frame, which you don't often see.
That's interesting. Yeah, I feel like a lot of it intersects quite closely with feminist principles, and I don't know how much you think feminism is already part of politics or not.
Well, I mean, it is, isn't it?
But yeah, I've always sort of felt very, not always maybe, but a lot of my life have been fairly apolitical, and probably that actually started with illness and just not caring about anything, including politics, and then finding that I barely read any news, and I mean, there's all kinds of ways of justifying. Yeah, exactly. But I don't know that it does the world any good for me to know what happened today in Trump land, for example. And of course, you can say that not knowing is just sort of morally abhorrent, and that we can't be informed citizens and make sensible choices about anything if we don't know the ins and outs of all that stuff. But I don't think that's actually true, and I think it becomes an addiction and a sort of titillation as much as anything. I don't know whether this is completely relevant, but at the moment I just find it more valuable to focus on stuff that I can practically make a difference to, and most of the political sphere doesn't feel like it's part of that.
What's he signaling? You know, it's a let's get outraged over this issue, which really we don't care about. But we like getting outraged, so we do that. But I don't know, it's just you being cynical, perhaps. So you've been an extremely successful academic. You did extraordinarily well in your undergraduate exams. As you mentioned, you received funding for your doctoral work. You then took up a 5-year junior research fellowship in St. John's College, Oxford, which is the best one to get.
Only 4 years.
4 years, sorry. So oh, my mistake. Oh, God, yeah. I retract it all. So in that sense, you are a paragon of what it means to succeed academically, and, you know, not just as a student, but as an undergraduate researcher as well. Yet at the same time, you've also worked in academic administration. And one of the things you did was to run an event on failure. And again, that struck me as a very kind of ballsy and interesting move to make, because in a place like Oxford, failure is not that it's invisible, because of course, you know, failure occurs everywhere. But at the same time, it's not perhaps as, and this isn't just Oxford, it's any university really, it just isn't something that you tend to encounter as a possibility, professionally speaking. It occurs, people sometimes acknowledge it occurs, and you're occasionally commiserated when it occurs, but that's really just, you know, a side effect. The main thing has to be success. So would you like to talk a little bit about what brought you to that emphasis upon failure?
I think it was back in 2012 or 13, I came across a lunchtime seminar, a lunchtime kind of chat and get-together that was happening here at Torch, the Research Centre in the Humanities, which was called, not quite what I called my event in the end, but something like Coping with a Sense of Academic Failure. And I'd always thought the title was really intriguing. Mm-hmm. And when I took up the postdoc training role in the humanities division here, it became increasingly clear to me from talking with my colleagues on the, you know, support and training side of things, and from all putting that together with all I'd known about how the research and teaching side of things work, that the way the academic system has been working for quite some time now is setting most people up for what is defined in academic terms as failure, i.e. not getting a permanent academic position, certainly not at professorial level, and also making everyone simultaneously too terrified to contemplate the possibility of that failure, and not just possibility, but likelihood, mm-hmm. statistically speaking, but also unwilling to contemplate at all the fact that it's probably going to be them who fails.
Mm.
Like, you always hear those things about, oh, it's only 0.45% of people who get to professor level, and you think, oh, well, yeah, that'll be me. Or else you think the opposite and think, Christ, that's awful, and I am doomed to failure. But then you keep on trying for that anyway, because what else could you possibly do? Because you've never, you know, you've come up through school where everyone was telling you how to get into university, and then through undergrad where everyone was telling you how to, you know, successfully do a master's and then a doctorate if you had the ambition to do that. And all these people have been self-selected in the sense that they've been successful within this system. Yeah, people are being trained for stuff that no longer exists. The jobs that existed 50 years ago in this sector just don't anymore. And I mean, nominally, some of them still do exist, but the actual forms those jobs take are radically different now. So it struck me that there was all kinds of interesting stuff going on in institutions like this and others about failure, and that, as with so many difficult things, one of the first important steps is always just to bring them out into the open and acknowledge that everyone has their own experience of either subjective or objective failure, or failing at job interviews and grant applications and all that stuff, or feeling, internalizing it as a feeling of personal failure or being a failure even, or just fearing that stuff so much that you never let it happen, and you organize your whole life around the necessity to avoid it by being absolutely perfectionist in everything you do and pushing in 50 hours when 3 would do, and you know, all that stuff, which is just classic academic behavior. So the failure event was lovely, and I was quite nervous about it because it would be very easy to get it very wrong and just end up wallowing in the ghastliness of everything. But I talked to all my speakers beforehand and tried to explore with them how to make it work more constructively than that, and tried to do sort of just logistical stuff, like having the right size of rooms and the right flow of people and all that kind of thing to make it work well too. And I think it did. And I think people were just, the overwhelming response seemed to be relief.
Yeah.
Like, I can believe Jesus Christ, other people feel this too. It's okay to talk about it. And so that led on to the creation of a series of podcast interviews and a workbook. And, you know, there's lots still to do, but I mean, if I compare the feel of this university now to when I started here as an undergraduate in 2000, we've come on so far. I mean, just mental health was not a thing then, and my quite severe anorexia was just totally under the radar for everyone, but that's just one example of just how blind everyone was to all these problems and certainly to the idea of doing anything about them. So I think, you know, it's easy to beat ourselves up about rising incidences of mental illness and all this stuff, but really, we are all on the right track, I think.
So do you think those rising incidences are the product of people being more aware that a problem exists and taking cognizance of it? Or do you think at the same time they are actually rising? I mean, I know you can't know the answer to that.
Yeah, who knows? I guess it's both. It's definitely the former anyway, especially amongst groups who would not typically be considered to be at risk of a certain disorder, mm-hmm. like men with eating disorders or any other type of person who doesn't feel it's kind of their territory. I think mm-hmm. that things are opening up in that sense. But there's so many other influences that push the other way. And I suppose when I said, like, we're all moving in the right direction, actually it's not true. There's a lot of positive movement and there's a lot of negative mm-hmm. movement, and things like expectations about work habits within the university sector, mm-hmm. for example, are just really detrimental and mm-hmm. need to be sorted out somehow. And mm-hmm. more broadly, I mean, I guess just... I don't know, yeah, there's too much to...
There's a lot to it, there is. I mean, from my 10 cents worth, at least, is that, like, at least with a lot of university positions and university kind of reward systems, they're based on status and prestige and all of those intangibles, and they're exactly the things that make human beings hate themselves, which is, it did not a difference in relative wealth, not a difference in relative purchasing power, all the hard economic stuff, really, you can work with. It's when you feel humiliated by a difference in status, that's when the stuff kicks in, the really bad stuff, and it seems that that thrives like nothing else in a university environment, because it is geared to reward those kind of prestige distinctions. So I think any attempt to detoxify that, like what you did with the failure intervention, I think is definitely to be welcomed and replicated and spread across universities everywhere.
Yeah, it should take failure on the road.
Yeah. With that said, you are also at the moment in another kind of liminal position, which seems to be the actual choice today, with respect to academia and non-academia, in that you mentioned already that you're working with life coaching for people recovering from eating disorders, you're writing a book, you have associations with academic institutions, you work with academic researchers, but that isn't how you choose to define yourself anymore as a university-based researcher. How did you find making that transition, and what was it something you kind of drifted into, or was there a kind of a Damascene moment where you decided that this is what I'm going to do?
Bit of both, I suppose. I did the standard thing. Well, first I had the JRF at St John's, which was glorious, and everyone told me that once I'd had it, I would obviously be guaranteed a you know, the job of life, of choice.
Why do people say these things?
Yeah. So then I applied for lots of jobs that I didn't get. Well, not lots, but a few. But already at that point, actually, I was being quite selective. I decided that although my background was in German literature, I didn't want to apply for German studies jobs and wanted to ensure that I could do the cognitive literary stuff that I was really interested in, which limited my choices in this country a lot. Basically meant that I started applying mostly for research grants rather than for teaching jobs. Mm-hmm. And yeah, as I say, I had plenty of rejections, had a couple of job interviews that seemed very, very, one in particular that seemed very promising, and I gather I was second choice for. And came, you know, that was an interesting moment of coming very close to imagining working at a different institution, because mm-hmm. it wasn't Oxford, in a different part of the country, and pursuing this eating disorders and literature project quite systematically mm-hmm. for 5 years or whatever it would have been, and not getting that, and then subsequently not getting a few more related grants that I applied for, just felt like, I don't know, it started to make me think, well, there's probably some other ways of doing this research mm-hmm. that don't require that kind of institutional setup, and different ways of gathering data that aren't the kind of formal experiments that I'd had in mind. And then actually gradually came with the realisation that I really want that research to be done, this mm-hmm. research that we've been talking about and mm-hmm. follow up on the survey data. Actually, I'm not longing for it to be me who does it.
Yeah.
And the sort of processes of carrying out that research in the way that I think it would need to be good actually don't give me that much, you know, satisfaction or pleasure. I'd love to be sort of a high-level advisor to someone else doing the meeting issue, I think, at this point. So I don't know quite when that realisation about pulling apart the importance, to me very personally as well as sort of intellectually, of the project from the idea that it has to be my project and it must be me who does it. Like, that was quite an important shift, I think, that began. You know, you don't have to just... Leaving behind a certain type of academic life doesn't have to be about saying that you never cared about any of those stupid questions after all, or that you're not going to try and pursue them in different ways. It's just that way maybe isn't for me right now. And so that was one step along the way. Another, I suppose, was just a very personal sort of coincidental thing, which was my partner taking up a postdoc in California and wanting to be able to go and spend time with him there. It was a 2-year postdoc initially, wanting to have a significant amount of freedom to visit, and then making the decision a couple of times with positions that were open here to not pursue them because they would have made it necessary for me to be here most of the time. And then, you know, ending up then in California on a balcony in LA with suddenly not all the things to do that I thought I had to do. I mean, I was consumed a lot of the time in the first year by a big textbook project, which sort of took over my life. But once that was over, there was really suddenly a strange sense of I get to decide what to do with my time now. And I've really never had that, actually, because academic jobs are amazing in the sense, or a lot of them are a lot of the time amazing in the sense that no one's really telling you what to do. You have a vague job description, but it's basically up to you to define what it means to teach well and to research well. But I just basically always felt guilty at not doing enough and almost oppressed by the lack of expectations, because then I just created my own impossible expectations the whole time and somehow felt beholden to the employer or whoever, even though they never made me feel that way. It's been really liberating to just realise that it's possible to really decide what I do with my time now and where I put my energies, and that writing, like coming back to a previous question of yours, that writing the blog is real work. Like, this is now what I do, and it doesn't have to be squeezed into time when I'm not doing the proper journal articles, because that's like a significant part of my life now in supporting my financial survival. So at the moment I'm feeling actually really, really optimistic about this strange combination of things that I've put together, and I love having one foot still in the university, and I hope that will continue, because the support that Torch have given me in sort of exploring these weird combinations has been wonderful. And if the app project continues in the way that I hope it does, then I think the support of the university will be really invaluable in that. But it's lovely to have one or a few toes in here, but then also to have time and space to do my own things apart from that. So it's been probably 5 years or so of really being in a transitional state, and I didn't know at all to where, and now I feel like I have a sense of where I want to be and that this is kind of it.
Good. And I think you're being able to inhabit those several spaces simultaneously too, it gives you a freedom of refusal that you tend not to have when you're serving one master. And I think that's important, because a lot of research is kind of slightly constrained by that, the inability to say no, to say that this is not how I think it should be done, but instead the research body wants the research grant to be written in this kind of way with this kind of emphasis, and I will serve them what they want. You don't have that when you're working at least partially for yourself. I think that's important, and the field needs it. And that kind of segues into the last question that I'd ask, but not necessarily the last thing you want to say, which is to do with the bigger picture of all the stuff we've talked about. We talked about text, we talked about mental illness, we talked about eating disorders, we talked about academic careers and what's good about them, what's bad about them. You're a well-established academic, you're a well-established intellectual presence, you're a well-established public figure for the audiences that you wish to speak to. But I want to bring it back to that first orientation you had, which is as a humanities scholar. Do you have a vision of how humanities scholarship should change, or how it should be conducted? These visions are in kind of pretty short supply at the moment, so I think people would like to hear them if you have one. But, you know, do you have any kind of wisdom, I guess, that you've gleaned on the back of all the things that you've done that you think is worth communicating? Even if you think it isn't worth communicating, let alone stretched out.
To me, I suppose the boundaries between academic fields are becoming
more and more arbitrary feeling. Not in the sense that you don't need to start somewhere and that you don't need to acquire expertise, often in great depth and a great cost of time and effort, but that when you then start to ask any of the questions that really matter, you have to start talking to other people and making use of the expertise that they have also time-consumingly gathered and try to put the pieces together. And I think that the humanities have been worse than any other area in the university, in the academic world, at doing that. The humanities have done quite a bit of, you know, interdisciplinary, like, classes talking to historians or whatever, and, you know, that continues and that's important. But I think the sort of wider leaps across ditches that feel bigger has not really been something that most humanities people have embraced. And there's all kinds of sort of, yeah, like, status and hierarchy reasons why that hasn't happened, and lots of deep-rooted sort of philosophical anti-positivistic, anti-reductionist sort of stuff going on. But, you know, they're all just sort of caricatures of a certain way of doing science. And if you want to improve the way science is done, then do some. So, yeah, my vision for the future of the humanities, such as it is one that's all about being embedded in an enterprise that looks beyond those ways of signaling identity, as you say, and is more question-focused. It starts with questions. I think, yeah, maybe coming back to, you know, my parents' advice about my pre-doctoral crisis, you know, is there a question that you really want to answer? I think so many people whose research I hear them talking about don't seem to have ever even asked themselves that question.
Yeah.
Like, why do you care? What is it actually that you care about? Don't just give me your research proposal blurb. Tell me why you care.
Yeah, it's also true.
And then once you do that, you stop giving bad presentations that are just read off the script because the details of the specific technical words that you're using are basically all there is. You start to speak from a place that matters, and that filters all the way up, I think, to everything about the practice of research. But my hunch is that those questions about why it matters to people will much more often than not be profoundly interdisciplinary questions. Because they'll all be about stuff to do with, you know, why humans are the way they are or something, or how we can make humans happier, or why they've been miserable in the past or something. And you can't answer any of those questions without having a multiplicity of perspectives, I think. So, you know, trying to do cognitive literary or health humanities empirical and theoretical research is just one way of sort of responding to my own personal question about what matters, and everyone will find their own ways. But yeah, it means that research can't just be a sort of thing in a vacuum anymore, and that's I suppose why if I'm trying to do anything still that changes anything about academia, I guess it's like having one foot in and one foot out, and trying to like drill some holes through the carapace.
Yeah,
I think humanities in particular have a future only if they stop retreating.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom in there. Yeah, agreed.
Excellent, we've sewn it all up.
Yeah.